And this is the last part of the prologue, the author's note. With conspiracy so close to the surface of the American imagination, American reality, I can only approach with trepidation the task of discouraging you in advance from thinking my book the chronicle of some vast diabolical conspiracy to seize all our children for the personal ends of a small elite minority. Don't get me wrong. American schooling has been replete with chicanery from its very beginnings. Indeed, it isn't difficult to find various conspirators boasting in public about what they pulled off. But if you take that tack, you'll miss the real horror of what I'm trying to describe. What has happened to our schools was inherent in the original design for a planned economy and a planned society laid down so proudly at the end of the 19th century. I think what happened would have happened anyway, without the legions of venal, half-mad men and women who schemed so hard to make it as it is. If I'm correct, we're in a much worse position than we would be if we were merely victims of an evil genius or two. If you obsess about conspiracy, what you'll fail to see is that we are held fast by a form of highly abstract thinking fully concretized in human institutions, which has grown beyond the power of the managers of these institutions to control. If there is a way out of the trap we're in, it won't be by removing some bad guys and replacing them with good guys. Who are the villains, really, but ourselves? People can change, but systems can't without losing their structural integrity. Even Henry Ford, a Jew-baiter of such colossal proportions he was lionized by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf, made a public apology and denied to his death that he ever intended to hurt Jews. A too strict interpretation of Darwin made him do it. The great industrialists who gave us modern compulsion schooling inevitably found their own principles subordinated to systems' purposes, just as happened to the rest of us. Take Andrew Carnegie, the bobbin boy, who would certainly have been as appalled as the rest of us at the order to fire on strikers at his homestead plant. But the system he helped create was committed to pushing men until they reacted violently or dropped dead. It was called the Iron Law of Wages. Once his colleagues were interested in the principles of the Iron Law, they could only see the courage and defiance of the homestead strikers as an opportunity to provoke a crisis which would allow the steel union to be broken with state militia and public funds. Crushing opposition is the obligatory scene in the industrial drama. Whatever it takes, and no matter how much individual industrial leaders like Carnegie might be reluctant to do so. My worry was about finding a prominent ally to help me present this idea that inhuman anthropology is what we confront in our institutional schools, not conspiracy. The hunt paid off with the discovery of an analysis of the Ludlow Massacre by Walter Lippmann in the New Republic of January 30, 1915. Following the Rockefeller slaughter of up to 47 mostly women and children in the tent camp of striking miners at Ludlow, Colorado, Rockefeller agents had employed armored cars, machine guns, and firebombs in his name. As Lippmann tells it, Rockefeller was charged with having the only authority to authorize such a massacre, but also with too much indifference to what his underlings were up to. Clearly, said the industrial magnate, both cannot be true. As Lippmann recognized, this paradox is the worm at the core of all colossal power. Both indeed could be true. For 10 years, Rockefeller hadn't even seen this property. What he knew of it came in reports from his managers he scarcely could have read, along with mountains of similar reports coming to his desk each day. He was compelled to rely on the word of others. Drawing an analogy between Rockefeller and the Tsar of Russia, Lippmann wrote that nobody believed the Tsar himself performed the many despotic acts he was accused of. Everyone knew a bureaucracy did it in his name. But most failed to push that knowledge to its inevitable conclusion. If the Tsar had tried to change what was customary, he would have been undermined by his subordinates. He had no defense against this happening, because it was in the best interests of all the divisions of bureaucracy, including the army, that it, not the Tsar, continued to be in charge of things. The Tsar was a prisoner of his own subjects. In Lippmann's words, this seemed to be the predicament of Mr. Rockefeller. I should not believe he personally hired thugs or wanted them hired. It seems far more true to say that his impersonal and half-understood power has delegated itself into unsocial forms, that it has assumed a life of its own which he is almost powerless to control. His intellectual helplessness was the amazing part of his testimony. Here was a man who represented wealth, probably without parallel in history. The successor of a father who has, with justice, been called the high priest of capitalism. Yet he talked about himself on the commonplace moral assumptions of a small businessman. The Rockefeller Foundation has been instrumental throughout the century just past, along with a few others, in giving us the schools we have. It imported the German research model into college life, elevated service to business and government as the goal of higher education, not teaching, and Rockefeller financed University of Chicago and Columbia Teachers College have been among the most energetic actors in the lower school tragedy. There is more, too, but none of it means the Rockefeller family masterminded the school institution, or even that his foundation or his colleges did. All became in time submerged in the system they did so much to create, almost helpless to slow its momentum, even had they so desired. Despite its title, the underground history isn't a history proper, but a collection of materials toward a history embedded in a personal essay analyzing why mass compulsion schooling is unreformable. The history I have unearthed is important to our understanding. It's a good start, I believe, but much remains undone. The burden of an essay is to reveal its author so candidly and thoroughly that the reader comes fully awake. You are about to spend 25 to 30 hours with the mind of a schoolteacher, but the relationship we should have isn't one of teacher to pupil, but rather that of two people in conversation. I'll offer ideas and a theory to explain things, and you bring your own experience to bear on the matters, supplementing and arguing where necessary. Read with this goal before you, and I promise you your money's worth. It isn't important whether we agree on every detail. A brief word on sources. I've identified all quotations and paraphrases and given the origin of many, not all, individual facts. But for fear the forest be lost in contemplation of too many trees, I've avoided extensive footnoting. So much here is my personal take on things that it seemed dishonest to grab you by the lapels that way. Of minor value to those who already resonate on the wavelength of the book, useless, even maddening to those who do not. This is a workshop of solutions as well as an attempt to frame the problem clearly. But be warned, they are perversely sprinkled around like raisins in a pudding, nowhere grouped neatly as if to help you study for a test, except for a short list at the very end. The advice there is practical, but strictly limited to the world of compulsion schooling as it currently exists, not to the greater goal of understanding how education occurs or is prevented. The best advice in this book is scattered throughout and indirect. You'll have to work to extract it. It begins with the very first sentence of the book, where I remind you that what is right for systems is often wrong for human beings. Translated into a recommendation, that means to avoid the revenge of Bianca, we must be prepared to insult systems for the convenience of humanity, not the other way around.